91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. Most of us would say that being witty is a trait from birth. Not so, says Canadian writer Benjamin Arrett. Good afternoon, it's Joseph Cooper with Bonnie Berman. Arrett has written about the art of quick wordplay in his book, Elements of Wit, Mastering the Art of Being Interesting. He says that incisive wit can be learned, even practiced. As opposed to traditional humor, wit is creativity which appears to work at the speed of thought. Think of Oscar Wilde, Churchill, Dorothy Parker, or Groucho Marx. Also this hour, Linda Gastenheimer's Food and Dining will visit with frequent guest Jen Koretnik. Besides her writing and teaching pursuits, she's known as the Mango Mama. She's published a book about the mango. That's next, after the news. And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman with you on this Thursday afternoon. Well, we begin this hour with a discussion of wit. That is the ability to quickly make a clever line or comment. Wit differs from humor, as we'll find out from Canada's National Post editor and writer, Benjamin Arrett. He'll join us from Toronto. Now, Bonnie, before Mr. Arrett comes on, I want to remind you that you've promised that you'll make an effort to be extraordinarily witty today. I want to hear a lot of pearls come out of your mouth today.
Well, I hope we can keep our wits about us.
Okay.
Okay. Benjamin Arrett's book is Elements of Wit, Mastering the Art of Being Interesting. He says, wit is like a muscle. Don't use it and you'll lose it. Okay, so welcome, Benjamin.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's get into the substance.
I want to hear some pearls from
okay,
you, too.
Okay, let's get... wait, let's
the
get
pressure into, is on.
Yeah, it's on both of us. Okay. And what about you, Joe?
I can maybe quote you something from the Three Stooges.
That counts.
Okay, Benjamin, let's get into the substance of your book, okay?
Yes, please.
Okay, no wits, ands, or buts.
Oh, she's
punning. Oh, there we go.
Now she's punning.
Okay. Are we really capable of being an Oscar Wilde or a Dorothy Parker? Doesn't it come naturally to some and just not to others?
Well, that is a high bar to set. But even Oscar Wilde, it didn't come naturally to him. He did a lot of work at it to get to where he is. Basically, my thinking is that everyone has at least a spark, and then my book can help you fan that spark into a flame.
Speaking of Oscar Wilde, I didn't see this in the book. Perhaps it's not true, but that he was in Paris, in a Paris apartment, a dreadful apartment, on his deathbed, and he, before he died, he said that it had hideous drapes, and he said, well, one of us has got to go.
This wallpaper goes or I do,
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, right.
And that actually, so this is a perfect example, because he actually said that, it was about 2 months before he died, that he'd made that comment. He said, these would be some good last words for me. And but he has such a reputation for being witty that even though he didn't say it at that specific time, we all assume that he did.
Okay, so let's start with the question of what is wit and how does it differ from humor?
This is a good one. Okay, so I define wit in the book as spontaneous creativity. And the way I got to that is, and the way I got to writing this book, is I was looking for sort of a grand unified theory of what makes good things good. Or specifically, why do I like the things I like? And I'm talking about things like the plays of Tom Stoppard, the comedy of Louis C.K., poetry of Patricia Lockwood, music of Kanye West, essays of Christopher Hitchens, the best of Twitter. It's a long list. But the point is that you can't really say these things are funny. It's not like a through line that connects them all. What you can say is that they're witty. And that is, so that's how I got to the idea that this is something I'm very, very interested in. And then the next question became, is it possible to learn this? Can you do it? And or is it something you're either born with, and if you don't have it, tough luck. I was happy to find that in all of the biographies that I looked at, there was always at least some practice, some repetition, some real hard work that went into coming up with these quips.
Well, why do we feel so good when we're able to accomplish it and really throw off a good witticism?
I think it comes down to the idea of flow, which is a sort of a psychology term about being living in the moment, basically, which is, you know, your standard kind of new agey self-help aspiration. We all want to live in the moment and be present in our own lives. And if you're in the moment and you can toss off a quip that relates to something that someone just said, you're engaging with other human beings, we're social animals. Like, I really think if you do all those things, that is sort of the pinnacle of human activity.
We're going to be having wine columnist Fred Tasker on the program in a little bit. Of course, he's been doing
he's on now
for years.
Actually,
he's listening now.
He's in listening.
And I came up with one. He was talking about doing, you know, professional wine tastings.
Mm-hmm.
And I said I thought he was a swirling dervish, but nobody, it didn't seem to strike any chord at all.
Well,
you can.
I thought it was so clever.
I give you points. That's my professional opinion. That is clever, and and I work at a newspaper in my day job, and we have to write headlines for wine and drinks columns, and we've used I think every pun in the book, but that one we haven't used. So.
There you go. You can use it now. Okay, so now the question is, how do we do it? I just want to say you're saying it's spontaneous creativity, but then you're saying it takes effort. So how can effort be spontaneous?
Well, that's a good point. So, you have, let's say, Usain Bolt, the world champion sprinter. He's only sprinting for like 9 seconds, but he spends his whole life working up to those 9 seconds. I think the idea is to see the fact that everything you're reading and watching and listening to, all the culture that you're consuming, it has a purpose. It has a purpose that you are able to sort of pluck out the gems among it. Like, you have to use your sort of magpie mind to pick out the really good stuff and remember that that's the kind of stuff you're looking for. I think it's a mental training exercise, and that's where the hard work comes in.
So you spend a lot of time talking about the rapper Jay-Z, I guess probably the best-known rapper, and that he actually trained to peel off these rhyming raps. How did he do that, and seemingly with no effort?
For sure, yeah. He came up in the mean streets of Brooklyn, as he's will remind you, and time again in his songs, and he would compete in these rap battles called cyphers, where you're sort of in the streets rapping against someone. It's, if you've seen the movie 8 Mile, there's a good depiction of them in that movie. And it's all basically freestyle rhyming. So you're going right off the top of your head. You have to come up with insults to the other person. You have to brag about yourself. You have to carry the story forward. So these are the things that he trained at since he was a young man. And he used to have a spiral-bound notebook. He talks about this in his autobiography. And he would carry this notebook around until one day he realized it was too conspicuous carrying a notebook around, writing down rhymes whenever he thought of them. So he would train himself to remember them. And so it got him to the point, you know, the famously popularized by Malcolm Gladwell idea of 10,000 hours of practice. He put in at least that, preparing himself for these battles. So now it looks effortless when he goes in to do it.
Let's bring our listeners in. Do you consider yourself witty? Do you want to be witty but fear you're not able? Or if you want to show us your wit, you can call us at 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN, or you can write us email radio@WLRN.org.
Benjamin Arrett, Jay-Z notwithstanding, why is it so difficult if you consciously try to be witty that you seldom are?
Well, you can't, make the bottle of champagne fizzy when on the spot. You know, it takes time to get those bubbles in place. There's nothing less witty, less funny, less interesting than someone who is sort of straining to come up with a good line on the spot. It either comes or it doesn't. It's like, everyone will remember being in school and not having studied for a test. You're just sitting there trying to think of what the answers are. There's no amount of thinking that's going to bring them to mind. You had to put in the work ahead of time.
I'd like to talk about your condition, the fundamental, 5 fundamental conditions for developing wit. And as we said, Fred is on the line, and we'll talk about all 5 of them, but wait, 5, 1, 2, 3, yes, but I like the last one, refreshment. Now, I know some pretty witty people who don't drink.
Yeah, it's totally fair. It's, refreshment I put in, I couldn't not talk about alcohol. It's, I'm very clear that, you know, you have an optimum level of where you sort of have loosened any inhibitions and you're willing to sort of freely associate, but that level is not very many drinks, and when you go beyond that, you think you're much wittier than you are. And there are lots of people, and God bless them, who can get to that level or sort of maintain that level without any alcohol or any stimulants of any kind. And so certainly not necessary, but a lot of the great wits did find it useful.
Especially true with cannabis, I think, too.
Exactly. That's your Mitch Hedberg sort of style, school of thought.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so how do brilliance and creativity differ?
Well, that's a good one, because brilliance, I think you can be totally brilliant in a, I think this was a Michael Cheek sent me high, the psychologist who sort of pioneered the word flow. He talked about being brilliant and being creative, and you have a lot of people who might be, you know, excellent in the moment, but they're not necessarily creating something of lasting value, if you're talking about an artist or a writer. But, you know, being creative, in a sense, is, you know, it's, so you can... Yeah, be sort of someone who's building a lasting project and something, a magnum opus, or you're someone who's, you know, intensely fun to be around. And I guess I come down on the side of being intensely fun to be around.
Right. I liked your dedication. You said you borrowed your dedication from P.G. Woodhouse. Which was his part and which was yours? You want me to read it? Or do you
Sure, please do.
Okay, I'm going to read it. It says, "To my children, Helena and Theodore, without whose never-failing sympathy and encouragement, this book would have been finished in half the time." So which part was P.G. Woodhouse?
Everything but the names of my children.
That's, okay.
That's one of his great... But as I say, there's a lot of borrowing. That's, you know, I said thing about Winston Churchill. He used all sorts of lines that he got from joke columns and movies and plays and books, and he would just... What he brought to that is the timing. He brought them in out in the middle of a parliamentary debate or at a club when all eyes were on him, and he got all the credit for it.
We're speaking
I'm trying to take...
Go ahead.
I'm trying to take a little bit of credit for that one.
Yeah, okay. That's good. We're speaking with Benjamin Arrett. He's a witty author and the managing editor for features at Canada's National Post, where he writes a weekly column on wit. And he's written Elements of Wit, Mastering the Art of Being Interesting. A short break, and we will be right back.
And 20 minutes past 1 o'clock, Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, Benjamin Arrett. We're talking about his book, Elements of Wit, Mastering the Art of Being Interesting. If you'd like to come on the air and be interesting, and don't fail us.
And charming.
1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. Email radio at WLRN.org. And we have a first caller. This is my friend, my witty friend, Ed in Miami. Hello, Ed. Ed, you're up. Don't let me down.
Ed?
Ed.
The pressure getting to Ed.
We're counting on you, Ed.
Yeah. He bolted, I think.
Well, maybe we'll give him a chance. Let me read.
Wait a minute. Whoa, 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 whoa. No. I hadn't punched him.
Oh, okay.
There we go. Ed, you're on.
Oh, I apologize about that. I'm sitting here trying to figure out if I'm online or not.
No,
it was my fault. It was my fault. Go ahead.
No, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me on. I'd never talk about my own wit, but I have a close friend of mine that I've observed and admired. He's very witty. And I've noticed he's consumed a lot of his information from the internet, especially Reddit, you know, gathering his ideas from social media. And it's very interesting to observe. But I have a question for your caller. You know, how have you observed the internet and social media changing the way you pull in culture and, you know, developing your wit? Thank you.
That's a great question, Ed. Thank you. That's interesting. I have a whole piece on, a bit on Reddit in the book and Metafilter before that because I found, you know, an interesting forums of people asking, how can you become more witty? And basically they got to what I think is the right answer, which is don't try to regurgitate things that you've seen, any Monty Python or The Onion or The Simpsons. You really want to, you know, figure out the context of where you are, be well-read enough to be able to pull up on good ideas when necessary. To your point about social media, so I have a whole chapter on brevity and Twitter. Of course, brevity is the soul of wit. And so Twitter is an interesting case because you have here in theory a series with 140 characters and so many brilliant people on it. You would have wonderful epigrams being generated all the time. But in fact, you don't, because you have a lot of people repeating each other. It can sort of go down a rabbit hole pretty quickly. So anyway, it's very interesting to see how it sort of lets everyone's rough drafts of their imagination come out into public. And sometimes that's great, and sometimes less so.
Benjamin, there are lots of kinds of wit, and some can be mean-spirited or sarcastic. You're more interested in the wit that makes the world ever so slightly better, you say, the compassionate side of wit. Explain what you mean.
Well, see, I think I define wit as spontaneous creativity. So I think that there's no more reason that wit should be cruel than a painting should be cruel, or a statue, or a poem. It can certainly be nasty. Any work of art can be. It can be used to put people down. But it can also be used to create a bond between people when they're talking, whether it's something like people out on a date, in a job interview, just stepping on the elevator with someone else. Like, it's a little spark of something can just makes all human interactions better. So I figured, it can go either way. And if I get to choose, which I'm the author, I did get to choose, I decided I'm going to make this compassionate rather than cruel.
Evan writes, before NPR mistakenly, in my humble opinion, asked Neil Conan, he spoke of doing live interviews as thinking with the tip of one's tongue.
Mm, yeah, that's an excellent way to put it.
Yeah, that's very good.
You sort of don't want to be, you just have to be up there, have to have something to say. I mean, you guys know in your profession you can't have dead air, but at the same time you don't want to be nattering on with nothing to say. So it's walking that tightrope.
Actually, dead air can be one of the most powerful forces also, though.
That's true.
Everybody's ears go up suddenly. Oh, it's dead air. Oh, my gosh, I have to listen to this. How about Mae West versus Cary Grant?
I like both of these. These are some great silver screen stars. So you have Cary Grant, who is sort of the epitome of charm. He's in my chapter on charm, which I define as one of my elements of wit, because he's the guy, he was a great writer who wrote that the thing that keeps you watching his movies is you're always afraid he's going to mess up his suit in some way, which is an amazing thing to think that could carry him through his whole career. So he always had great lines. They were always scripted for him, but he would always make it look like, he was just this guy stuck in this funny situation, and what's he going to do? And he's just going to toss off a line, and you sort of relate to him, even though he's the most handsome man in the room. Mae West, on the other hand, you have someone who just was the sort of great sex symbol of her age of cinema. And this was also a time when basically there were extremely strict laws about that you couldn't say or show anything. So everything she did on screen would have to be suggestive, to the point where she could, every little comment she made was taken to be a double entendre. So she had built this, both of them, I guess, as movie stars, had built up this persona of they're going to do something, he's going to do something charming, and she's going to do something risque. And basically the audience came in and they were halfway to the punchline before they even opened their mouths.
What about wit and writing? Brings to mind one of my favorite Dorothy Parkers talking about reviewing a movie with Katharine Hepburn in it, saying, Miss Hepburn's performance covered all the human emotions from A to B.
She did have some excellent ones. As a theater critic.
Yeah, not Audrey.
I think she also had, this book should not be put aside, it should be tossed with great force.
Yes.
Yeah, so it's interesting, if you think of it as being spontaneous, if it's on the page, it just has to sort of feel spontaneous. It has to have that sort of freshness and new ideas that you hadn't thought of before. It's an interesting challenge, because if you think spontaneity in conversation is, you just have to know the person doesn't have a script. But on the page, you would hope that they've spent lots of time refining each and every sentence. So if it doesn't feel labored, and it obviously was labored, then you're already part of the way there.
What about romance? Because you have a little section on that. Where does that come in?
Well, obviously, as everyone, I think when I referenced earlier, the people on the internet looking for ways to become witty, wooing the opposite sex is obviously one of our primary goals as animals. So, and wit is one of the advantages we have over the rest of the animal kingdom. So, you have this way, this sort of George Costanza effect. You have this guy who's not particularly good-looking or successful or doesn't really have much going for him at all, and yet he manages to always be dating wonderful women. And it's in the show, of course, he had a team of writers creating that character. But you have the idea that he's able to have a conversation. He's able to respond to what the other person is saying. I mean, this kind of stuff goes a long way. It seems like not much, but then you look out there and you realize the bar is not that high.
And what about resilience?
Oh, so resilience, this is, I think, one of my favorite ones, because it really shows how, you know, when you're stuck in a moment and you realize you sort of, you know, you want to change the trajectory of, you know, the day, your career, your entire life, you can reach for them, that grab the moment and push it in the direction you want it to go. So I talk about Groucho Marx, how he was basically at one point in his career was totally washed up, and he was on a radio show, a live radio show with Bob Hope, and he managed to take a sort of shop-worn skit and turn it into something that was uproarious to the entire audience. And that got a TV producer interested, and he got it on to his sort of the next stage of his career. His TV show came after that. I talk also about Nora Ephron, who, of course, is the late Nora Ephron, who is a famous wit in her day for her in her turns of phrase, but then in sort of a greater sense for life, she when her husband left her, she turned it into the book Heartburn, which then became the movie. And instead of being sort of a spurned woman, she really took control of her story, made it, she always said that everything is copy, and for her, the copy was about her.
How about the wit and pianist Oscar Levant?
Oh, he's a great one. I have to actually credit Jacob Lazarevic, my father-in-law in Boca Raton, for putting me towards Mr. Levant.
Maybe he's listening.
He is. I know that
he is. So you worked him in. That's very good.
I worked him in. He said, David, how about Oscar Levant? I had never heard of him. But he's really a fascinating character. He's basically America's first celebrity meltdown. He was a George Gershwin's sort of protege. He would come up, and when Gershwin died early, he would interpret his oeuvre for the American public. And then he got a radio show where he was coming up with quips all the time. But the problem was he could not control his mouth. So his quips would often be, you know, take it one step too far and got him in trouble with the censors. And eventually he had his TV show taken away from him. He ended up in a mental institution. He's in my chapter on intuition, because this idea that you just let your mouth go and you can, you know, free associate and come up with something clever, there are obviously limits to that. People who, if they let their mouth go, they're not going to like where it goes.
What is this hustle? And that's one of the fundamental conditions for developing wit, you say. What is hustle?
I talk about hustle as being hard work, basically. The idea that you are out there always looking for good lines, making sure you notice them when you see them, and the sort of things you want to emulate. The first step to getting to this sort of state of what you saying, the kind of things you want to say when you want to say them, is knowing what the things you want to say are. So that's the sort of work that you put into it. And, you know, in Churchill's day, it was reading widely. But today, I think it's watching stand-up comedy. I think it's paying attention to, you know, clever jokes on Twitter. It's consuming culture, basically, and consuming it with an eye to learn from it.
That's interesting. Sure. That's a very interesting, you know, how you say in contemporary times, you know, we have to just be more contemporary, and that's how we can actually learn wit.
Churchill, my tastes are very simple. I like only the best.
Exactly. It's, I mean, everything he says, you just put Churchill after it, and people are automatically have sort of this air of grandeur about it. But of course, it wasn't that way in his time. He really built this up over his career, and now to the point where there's all, you know, you can almost any sort of statement that you can put Churchill or Wilde behind, it will automatically give it an extra, you know, extra credibility.
Benjamin, you have a website, elementsofwit.com,
mm-hmm.
And do you have any other? You have a column in the National Post.
You can follow Elements of Wit at Twitter, at Elements of Wit on Twitter, and I tweet out great lines that I've found throughout the research of the book. And, of course, I have the book itself, which is in stores. I really think, you know, going into the holiday party season, you've got all these people to talk to, conversation to make with people from the office or uncles you haven't seen in a long time.
Yeah, maybe some of your relatives in Boca Raton or...
Yeah, exactly. Oh, there's a Hanukkah party I'll be attending, and I'll have to do that.
So. I love it. Go ahead.
Oh, it's just, yeah, you want to... I'll have to make jokes about this book, so it's very meta. But I think that, you know, this book, it's sort of, I think it's entertaining to read, but it also sort of opens the door to thinking about how you can how you can get to become more witty. Just thinking about the process of actually doing it is really the first step.
Well, we will have a link to Elements of Wit, Mastering the Art of Being Interesting, on our website, as well as your website, elementsofwit.com. That will all be at WLRN.org. Benjamin Errett is an author and the managing editor for Features at Canada's National Post, where he writes a weekly column. And I just wanted to say, Joe, that today's program might not have happened without us.
Food and Dining is next.
Thanks, Benjamin.
It was an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Back. It's 34 minutes past 1 o'clock. Joseph Cooper along with the almost witty Bonnie Berman.
Thanks.
It's Food and Dining Thursday has arrived. We have chef, author, and syndicated columnist Linda Gassenheimer. She's returned from her far-flung travels. And we have a longtime close colleague with us in the studio today in a bit different role. She's usually here on Linda's famous restaurant roundabouts, but that's not happening today. Linda, how was the Pillsbury Bake Off? I guess we'll have the winner on Topical Currents in a while.
Yes, we will. And everyone.
And I saw a picture of you hugging an 8-foot Pillsbury doughboy.
Yeah, he was really cute.
It must have been hot inside that for that guy.
I know he has a fan. There's a fan going on inside. Yeah, we're going to hear a lot more about it. It was a really interesting and people can vote. If you want to vote for the $1 million winner, you can go to vote.bakeoff.com and put in your vote. But today we're talking about something else. So Florida's known for its oranges, its key limes, but I think mangoes are really close contender, don't you think?
Absolutely.
There's nothing like a ripe mango picked from the tree and still warm from the sun. They're sweet, they're juicy, and a major treat. And our guest today knows a lot about mangoes. And as you already mentioned, she's one of our favorite guests from our restaurant roundabout. It's Jen Koretnik. Her latest book is called Mango. Welcome, Jen.
Hi, Linda. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you here and talking about mangoes instead of restaurants.
She sounds like a regular guest all of a sudden.
Okay. Yeah, it's a lot of practice.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Nice to be here. You know, nice to see you guys.
Thanks for you, Jen.
Thanks
for taking
my call.
Be back in December. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Anyway, we'd love to hear from all of you.
Long-time caller, first-time listener.
Well, we'd like to hear from our listeners. Give us a call if you want to join in and ask Jen about some mangoes. How do you use them? How do you cultivate them? Whatever you want to ask her. That's 800-743-9576, 800-743-9576. WLRN. Do we have internet today, Bonnie?
We do. It's radio at WLRN.org.
Clearly something went on here before we came
well,
in.
Well, she always says that like it's 1982 or something. Do we have the internet?
Well, the point is sometimes our internet is not up. Sometimes it's not working.
Yes,
and I
that
wanted
is
to make
true,
sure
Joe.
It was working.
It's okay. Like she worked with Marconi or something.
Yeah, oh, Linda, he's picking on you today.
Yeah, for 16 years he's been picking
that,
on
that,
me.
That wit segment's kind of got
know,
me on a roll.
I know.
Well, let's get another witty person on, Fred Tasker, our favorite wine guy. He's joining us by Skype, and you can read Fred's wine suggestions for my Dinner in Minutes columns. That's in today's Miami Herald. You can also read his wine column. It's now on Saturday in the food section of the Miami Herald. Fred, what are we drinking today?
Well, Joe and Bonnie, today you have the Lunch Goddess, the Mango Mama, and the Swirling Dervish. How can you go wrong?
Oh, you were listening, Fred.
We thought you were making a
sandwich.
I was
just bursting to get into that part of the conversation.
Listen, Fred, he had a quote in the book from Mark Twain I thought you'd like. I find
this
that
is from the program before the food program.
Yeah. Right. I find that about 2 glasses of champagne are an admirable stimulant to the tongue, though wine is a clog to the pen.
I would agree with that.
Oh, I don't go along with that second part.
Well, I like that. That works for me.
Yeah. Well, usually, I mean, friends.
Okay, well, let's go back to mangoes,
okay?
All right, the mangoes. Jen, you're a great restaurant critic. We know that.
Oh, I thank you.
But how did you come to writing about mangoes?
Well, it was an accident of fate, I guess you could call it. My husband and I moved into this wonderful house, this old house on an old mango plantation, and we had no idea what we were getting into. And
coming from the big city, huh?
Coming from the big city of South Beach, yes. we really wanted fruit trees, and I think that was a very romantic notion. And, you know, I applaud my old self for having that romantic notion, and I also curse my old self for having that romantic notion, because it led us to this place that, you know, has this name, Mango House. And when we saw it, we thought, wow, that's just, it's a beautiful house.
So that was
house.
The name of the house?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful house. It originally had 18 mango trees on it, on the property, and it is really the last acre of Miami Shores', you know, huge mango plantations before they were divided up into suburbs. So this was the original mango picker's cottage, and it's been added onto over the years. And right before its final renovation, before we moved in, there were 18 mango trees standing. When we moved in, there were 11. What happened to the 18?
18.
The former owner took out 7 of them.
With them?
To put an addition on. To me, you know, it was probably unnecessary. And I would have loved to have known which mangoes those were. Mm. And all the documentation has been lost. So I really
don't. Well, Jen, with 11 mango trees, have you ever counted how many mangoes do you think you grow in a year?
It's quite possible that we get up to 1,000 pieces of fruit per tree. And
Per tree.
And
that's huge. A thousand per tree?
Yeah.
And now you have 14 trees.
Well, now we have 14 because we did something even stupider than moving into a house that had 11 mango trees. And that was 1 year when they were taking a year off, which mango trees sometimes do take some time off. We went out and bought 3 more and planted them because we thought we should really keep up the legacy of this property and plant some more trees.
So what do you do with all those mangoes every year?
We throw them at people. Please take them off our hands. Well, we started by giving them to friends, and then we expanded by giving them to chefs, and then we expanded by driving up and down Biscayne Boulevard begging people to take them. I'm not even kidding.
We had this show on food waste, and there was a woman on, I forgot her name now, I'm sorry, but she said there was a program called neighborhoodfruit.com, I believe.
Yes, and I tried to start something like that about 10, 12 years ago, and I actually picked all of my neighbor's trees as well, because it killed me to see mango trees unpicked, dropping their fruit when people are going hungry.
Right.
And I used to donate the fruit to a program called Food for Life, which fed homebound AIDS patients. And they don't exist any longer, but I used to bring the fruit to them, and they were always so grateful. But a lot of the food programs around here don't take fresh fruit, and they won't take fresh fruit or fresh food that's unpackaged because they're suspicious now. So it's a real shame that you can't just your food.
You're very good at making sure all these mangoes get used. You connected with a lot of our chefs here in town, so tell us about that.
Yes, it's fortunate, you know, that after a while I became friends with a lot of the chefs, and then I realized that not only were they pals, but they actually lived in my neighborhood. So Andrea Curta Randazzo and her husband Frank Randazzo were right around the corner. Dewey
they
Lasasso.
They used to have Tallulah, the restaurant.
Right. Yeah. Dewey Lasasso, who had, at that time, he had North 110. He was right around the corner. Douglas Rodriguez lives in Miami Shores. So I started calling them up and saying, look, come get some mangoes. You can use them in the restaurants. I don't care, you know, what you do with them. Just please use them. And they were more than happy to.
And Alan Susser, who's another mango.
Well, Alan Susser, who's such a good guy, you know, he himself was inundated with mangoes when he had Chef Allen's, because he had that program, which you probably know about, where if you brought him mangoes, he would weigh them. And once you reached 200 pounds of mangoes, he kept a ledger. He would give you a free dinner for two. So walking into his kitchen, and I would do this once in a while. I would bring him some mangoes just because he loved to see all the different varieties. He's really a mango guy. Walking into his kitchen during prime mango season was like walking into Aladdin's cave. It was just piled high with all different colors and shapes of mangoes. It was like jewels. And you could see, you know, the glee on his face was so funny, because the prep cooks, who were the ones who had to peel and chop and slice all the mangoes, if you walked in with more mangoes, they would look at you like, I'm going to kill
no.
you.
How many varieties do you have?
We have 8 varieties.
Eight.
8.
What's your favorite?
I like what we have. Our favorite tree, my husband and I, is the Irwin. We have one Irwin tree, and they grow in little purple clusters, and they have absolutely no fiber in them at all, and they're a little bit tart. So you don't have this like tremendous sweetness to them that, you know, I find a little bit overpowering.
So they're
sometimes
easy to seed, I guess.
They're just delicious. I mean, you can eat one after the other, and you know, mangoes can be very easy to seed. You just slice them right down the cheeks.
Talk about eating. We've got some food here that you brought in. So tell us what you, because you've got recipes in the books from all the chefs.
I do.
And what have we got here?
Well, this is actually the first recipe I ever made with the mangoes, because I had never actually picked a mango before I moved into this house. I'd never cooked with a mango before I moved into this house. So the first thing I made, of course, was the easiest thing to make, which is mango salsa. Because to make a fruit salsa, all you need is a source of fruit, an onion, a source of citrus, and some cilantro or a similar kind of herb.
Really
so
nice.
It was very easy for me to do that. And then, of course, you start perfecting what you like, you know, the ratios.
So what's
of what
in this
like.
Salsa?
Well, this salsa, because I actually got really lucky yesterday. I was in the market. I was intending to make you a mango cake using mangoes I had frozen. I know, you're like, but then you just came back from the Pillsbury cook-off, so you don't want
cake.
Any more cake.
Okay.
And I was thinking, you know, I'll use some of the frozen mangoes, and you can use frozen mangoes all year long, and you can bake with them. You just have to defrost them first, so you have the right ratio of fruit, doesn't get watery.
We're going to break soon, but tell me, how do you pick, when you go? You went to the supermarket, how do you know it's a good one?
I went to the supermarket.
When you're looking at those mangoes.
Well, I will hardly ever buy a mango in the supermarket, because even in prime mango season, you see mangoes from Mexico when you have Haydens dropping in your backyard, and it's kind of an insult to the South Floridians. There were these beautiful mangoes from Brazil. There were these, and there were only 5 of them, honey mangoes from Brazil, and they had sap on them, which to me says they left them on the tree long enough to be picked when they were ripe.
All right.
Wow.
We have to take a break, but would you just tell us when we come back how to defrost them properly?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break here. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. We're talking with Jen Koretnik and about her new book called Mango. We'll take a short break, and we'll be back with more. We're back. I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and we've been talking with Jen Koretnik. You hear her here and with our restaurant roundabout programs, but now she's written a book called Mango, and she's also known as Mango Mama, because everybody knows that Jen has mangoes. She's been telling us about her mango orchard and giving us tips on how to use the mangoes. And Jen, you're going to be at the book fair?
I am. November 22nd, I'll be reading from my 2 new poetry books, which came out very close to the cookbook. So it's been a little crazy, but I'll be reading from them at 10 and then signing the cookbook and reading from the cookbook at 12:30. Both in the same building, which
Saturday.
Is very convenient on Saturday.
Do you have any poems about mangoes?
Yeah, that's the first thing I did, of course, was forget cooking with them. I wrote poems about them.
Great.
And you said some of your students are going to be reading?
Yes, and the book fair was so nice. They invited my entire high school creative writing program to read at the book fair on Friday. So they'll be reading at the Swamp, which is their new programming, from 12 to 1 on Friday.
Okay, and so people don't realize that Jen, in addition to everything else, she's a teacher.
Oh, yeah.
So these
educator.
Are students.
Educator.
Educator.
Yeah, we don't call them teachers anymore, you know.
I'm sorry.
Call them educators.
Is that politically incorrect now to say teacher?
I don't know. I just, whatever.
So quickly, before we have dinner in minutes, give us a quick idea of what to do with frozen mangoes, how to defrost them.
I defrost them in the refrigerator so that they defrost slowly, and I make sure to put them in a bowl so that when they defrost, they can get a little watery. They don't spread all over the bottom of your refrigerator.
Okay.
Okay. So, all right. So now it's dinner in minutes time. And today's dinner in minutes is a taste of the Caribbean. It's mojo glazed steak with a quick rice and beans. Many of you maybe know that mojo is a garlicky, spicy sauce. And there are lots of varieties in the market you can find. And sometimes it's also called a Spanish barbecue sauce. And this recipe is so easy. I have skirt steak, and I maybe cook it about 3 minutes a side. A meat thermometer should read about 145 for medium rare. Then I take the steak out. I mix some mojo sauce with a little orange marmalade, and I put that in the pan and melt. It becomes a glaze, and you put it over the steak. Couldn't be easier. Real simple. Maybe 10 minutes it'll take you to do that. And for the rice and beans, I just cook up some rice, and I rinse and drain black beans, put them all together, and toss them with a little olive oil and salt and pepper. Now that complete recipe and a photo, it's at dinnerinminutes.com. You can read another steak recipe. It's in today's Miami Herald. It's another Caribbean recipe. It's a grilled Cuban steak, and I've adapted it from the Versailles Restaurant cookbook. So it's a fun recipe, and that's in today's Miami Herald. And please follow me on Twitter. That's at L. Gassenheimer. Fred, what are we drinking?
Well, we're talking about mangoes and wine. So as it turned out, I did research this topic several years ago when I did a wine seminar at the International Wine Mango Festival at Fairchild Tropical Botanical Garden. And I found some wonderful matches, that they were actually quite varied. At the tart end, I had to match a wine with a spicy green mango salad containing mangoes with onions, red bird's eye chilies, lime juice, and spicy Thai fish sauce.
Well, that sounds delicious.
That'll burn you up.
Oh, it's a wonderful salad. And this is a very tart, spicy, high-acid dish, so I matched it with a tart, spicy, high-acid Sauvignon Blanc. Went very nicely. But mangoes can also go with savory dishes. I found a recipe for a chicken black bean stew with big chunks of mango in it that was matched perfectly by a big, oaky, buttery California Chardonnay. And of course, as Jen was talking about, if you're eating fresh mangoes straight out of hand with the juice running down your arm, you want a slightly sweet Moscato, maybe even a sparkling Moscato. That's a very nice combination.
Ooh, I could see that with a little mango puree in the morning at brunch. Yum.
Yeah, that's good for you, too.
Oh, yes, of course it's good for you.
Finally, there's dessert. No chocolate, though, Linda, I'm sorry. But
you
I came across a super sweet Thai mango pudding made of extra ripe mangoes, coconut milk, and lots of sugar. And with wine and sweet things, the rule of thumb is that the wine should always be sweeter than the dessert. Otherwise, it makes the wine taste kind of thin and metallic. So you need a super sweet dessert wine with that, like Sauternes or even ice wine, something like that. Now, Jen, I understand you have some rum mango drinks in your book. And
Yes. As
you know probably better than I, with 11 mango trees, you either have no mangoes at all or tons and tons of mangoes.
Yes, that's true. Well, my trees have gotten smart, though. They don't take a year off anymore because they know that I'm picking them. So now
they
only take sides off.
Mangoes out for
yeah.
you.
Sometimes they just take a quarter of a side off.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, they're.
Well, how do you keep them short? Because they get.
That's a problem because when we moved into the house, they were already overgrown. So our mangoes are pretty large. They're about 90 years old, and they can produce up to 300 years old.
And
boy, you've got a lot to look forward to, Jen.
I hope I live that long, Fred.
Anyway, I used to puree a bushel or two of mangoes and pour them into ice cube trays and freeze them. Then all year long, you can toss a few of those in a blender with some rum and make that frozen concoction that helps you hang on.
That helps you hang on. That gives you a long life. Yeah, and that's an excellent way also to make sangria. You can just toss those into a couple of liters of red or white wine with some fresh cut up fruit, and you have, instead of watering down your wine, you have cooling, nice chunks of fruit.
Sounds good. You know, my mother used to do that with peaches. She would freeze them, and if you thaw them out after that, they get a little mushy. So what she would do is take them out of the freezer and wait till they're about 1/3 thawed, and then serve them that way, and they'd have a little crunch of ice in them. They're really good.
Delicious.
Making us all thirsty. Let's go to Gary. Gary in South Miami. Hi, Gary. You're on the air.
Hi. Problem of what to do with the mangoes. I gave hundreds away to two places this year. One is the Chapman Partnership for the Homeless, which is near the school board on Miami Avenue and 13th to 14th Street, something like that.
They're right
in the
where
phone
we
book.
Are. Right where the studio is. Yeah.
And the other one I gave away, especially if you're in Broward, they don't have a location in Dade County, but they'll send somebody around with a truck to pick them up from the Feeding South Florida. They're very happy to get them.
Okay. I love the sending around with the truck part. That part sounds really good to me.
Okay.
Yeah, I've done that before. I freeze a bunch, and I give them away to people at my synagogue, and I give them all to the neighbors. And then I said, well, nobody's going to eat that many, so I just took them. One day, this was 2 years ago. Last year, we didn't have any mangoes at all, but 2 years ago, we had a bumper crop, and I started taking them to the Partnership for the Homeless. They're very, very happy to get them.
Okay, well, if they rot on the ground, don't they fertilize it?
Thank you very much for your call, Gary.
Well, you know, you would think that they fertilize it, and we don't use any fertilizer, and we don't use chemicals or anything like that, but what they do is they root themselves.
Oh.
So suddenly you have hundreds of tiny little mango trees.
I see.
Right. So I mentioned in your book, Mango, that you have a lot of recipes from the chefs and all. And then you mentioned the fact that we only have half a minute left, but a mango gang, that there's the chefs call themselves the Mango Gang. Who are they?
Well, the Mango Gang, Alan Susser, Mark Militello, Norman Van Aken, Douglas Rodriguez, I believe that they were christened that by, wasn't it you?
Yes, somebody you know.
Somebody I know?
When I first moved here, I was amazed by them. And we used to get together and have lunch and talk about recipes and what they were doing here.
So yeah. they became known that way, but it was, you know, something they became known for. Also, for cooking with tropical ingredients and things like that. And now they are still known for it and have passed it on to the next generation. But I'm not sure they still like being pigeonholed that much.
They've gone beyond that.
Yeah.
Well, we could continue to talk for a long time.
Of course.
It's been a very tasty week. Thank you for this mango salsa. Delicious.
Thank you, Jen Karetnik.
She'll be appearing at the Miami Book Fair on Saturday, November 22nd. And her book is called Mango, and it's really a very delicious read. Fred Tasker, great advice as always.
Always a pleasure.
Joe Cooper and Bonnie Berman, good to be with you. You ate well today.
Thanks so much. Welcome back.
Thank you. Well, next week we're going to be talking with Michael Love from Epicure Market. His book is Salvage Chef Cookbook, and he's going to teach us how to use up all that trash food in our refrigerator.
All right.
I'm Linda Gassenheimer. Join me then.
And thanks for tuning in. Apologies to those callers we couldn't get on the air. Topical Currents is produced by Richard Ives. Technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. We have free audio archives at our website, WLRN.org. And more information, links, photos, and discussion at the TC Facebook page. Tomorrow at 1, it's Ed Bell and the South Florida Arts Beat. Bonnie Berman and I return Monday with some perhaps troubling information about retirement and the average worker. Writer James Russell addresses the retirement crisis. Calendar time. On this day in 1917, 97 years ago, the Bolshevik coup d'etat begins with the capture of the Winter Palace in St. Petersburg, Russia. And on this day in 1962, 52 years ago, after losing his second election in a row, this one to Pat Brown for the governorship of California, Richard Nixon gives a concession speech and retires from public life. And more while we recall anarchy in the UK. On this day in 1975, 39 years ago, the Sex Pistols, a pioneer punk band, play their first gig at St. Martin's School of Art in London. The original Pistols, Johnny Rotten, Steve Jones, Paul Cook, and bassist Glenn Matlock. Sid Vicious would replace Matlock in early 77. Best known for their 1977 single God Save the Queen, they refused induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. So we leave with this from John Lydon, formerly Johnny Rotten. If you were to look back at me as a school kid, you'd see a very quiet little church mouse kind of character. This is Joseph Cooper for the witty Bonnie Berman. Thanks for making public radio your companion today. Stay tuned for Here and Now next from NPR News.